genocide of war on the besieged strip. Here she is.
The Israeli occupation army targeted whole residential blocks belonging to families like Hamad, Baalusha, Zakut, Al-Husari and Al-Khudari families. These are actually whole families are being buried out, buried under the rubble of these destroyed buildings or residential blocks in the north of Gaza. More explosive laden rockets are actually triggered in these very populated or densely populated areas in west of Gaza. Since the dawn of this morning until now, at least 5 explosive-laden rockets were actually directed to the most densely populated areas in Tell el-Hawa in the south or the southwest of Gaza City. This actually is a tactic the Israeli occupation army is using against the civilians in the city of Gaza to terrorize them and to force them out towards the allegedly safe zones in the south of the city. However, the massacres are relentlessly continuous. The massacres are actually unabated and that targeting the most vulnerable groups of people for sure. More people are still also dying and literally dying because of starvation and malnutrition. In the past 24 hours, at least 3 more people died because of starvation, and that includes also another child.
For the first time, UN investigators have formally declared the Israeli regime is perpetrating genocide in Gaza with the intent of destroying the Palestinian people residing there. UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry also implicated Israel's prime minister and other senior officials for their role in incitement. The commission released its most recent report nearly 2 years after the launch of the Israeli genocidal campaign.
It is occurring in Gaza and is continuing to occur, and the responsibility lies with the state of Israel. We identified 3 persons in this report, and that is Prime Minister Netanyahu, the former Minister of Defense, Gallant, and the President of Israel, whose statements inciting genocide is recorded faithfully. So it's a 2-year work, it's not just something we made up now. And as we set out all the facts, and we looked at videos, footage, we talked to experts, we talked to doctors, witnesses, children. After that massive investigation, we are, of course, the only UN body that is authorized to investigate. We're not allowed inside Israel, so we had witnesses come out to us. So that's just a little bit about our methodology. So I want to stress how careful we were in reaching that conclusion. Because those 3 individuals acted as agents of the state, we hold the state of Israel responsible for genocide.
The Hamas resistance movement has strongly slammed the international community's failure to stop Israeli crimes in Gaza. The movement's statement came as Israel is pressing ahead with its military aggression in Gaza City, demolishing high-rise buildings and forcefully displacing residents. Hamas said fascist Israeli army's brutal aggression against Gaza City constitutes full-fledged crime of ethnic cleansing and genocide, adding regime continues to commit such crimes amid glaring international inaction and lack of decisive will on the part of the international community to stop them and hold the perpetrators to account. Hamas stressed Israel's crimes will fail to weaken the resolve of Palestinians, though, who will continue their resistance and make the occupying regime pay dearly for its horrendous crimes. Hamas warned Israel's war criminal prime minister bears full responsibility for the fate of captives held in Gaza, and he will not succeed in releasing them through his criminal policies. The Israeli prime minister has acknowledged the regime is facing increased isolation on the world stage. The acknowledgement comes amid massive international backlash against Tel Aviv over the genocide in Gaza.
Also know that there is currently an attempt to impose a siege on Israel by various entities and countries, led by Qatar. First and foremost, a media siege funded by massive amounts of money from Qatar and other countries like China. They are operating in the West, and no less so in the United States. The second part is more focused, and it is centered in Western European countries, through the activation of Muslim minorities there, who are becoming vocal, violent, and threatening the states. That's why we see this siege concentrating in Western Europe. As I said, Arms shipments to us are being halted. This is happening now.
Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking at a finance ministry conference in Al-Quds. He said regime has no choice but to stand on its own and become less reliant on external trade in the face of growing isolation. Netanyahu said Israel's arms industries are blocked, adding regime needs to develop its own weapons industry. Opposition leader Yair Lapid reacted to Netanyahu's comments, saying isolation is a result of flawed and failed policy adopted by the Israeli prime minister. This as Spain has canceled a weapons contract worth hundreds of millions of euros with Israel over regime's ongoing onslaught on Gaza. The deal, worth nearly 700 million euros, would have seen Spain buying Israeli-designed rocket launchers from Elbit Systems. Move followed a Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez pledge to turn into law a ban on all military sales or purchase deals with Israel over the regime's atrocities in Gaza. Madrid has also scrapped another contract valued at 287 million euros to buy anti-tank missile launchers, which were to be manufactured under license from an Israeli company. On Monday, Sanchez also called for Israel to be barred from international sports over the Gaza war. He expressed deep admiration for thousands of protesters who forced the halt of the final stage of the Vuelta a España, one of the world's biggest cycling events, in Spain on Sunday. Luxembourg will join a number of European nations in recognizing the state of Palestine at the upcoming UN General Assembly as outrage has grown over Israel's genocide in Gaza. Prime Minister Luc Frieden and Foreign Minister Xavier Bettel communicated the decision to a parliamentary commission. They asserted the move is being coordinated with several other European Union member states, including France and Belgium. Last week, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen confirmed EU executive will suspend payments to the Israeli regime and impose sanctions on extremist ministers and violent Israeli settlers. Decisions are part of EU's broader reassessment of its relations with the Israeli regime in light of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Nearly a dozen members of the European Union have already recognized the state of Palestine. The Global Samud Flotilla has commenced the final leg of its journey to war-torn Gaza, with the objective of breaking Israel's prolonged blockade of the region. In the past few days, several vessels have departed from ports in Greece, Tunisia, and Italy to join the mission. The flotilla originally set sail from Spain in late August and has already encountered two suspected Israeli attacks. Journalist and activist Fra Hughes, who's aboard the flotilla, joined us earlier with some details for us.
Our focus is purely on reaching Gaza. We continue to watch the evisceration of human lives. We continue to watch people being murdered simply trying to access food. We're watching the destruction of the further destruction of the infrastructure. We're witnessing 1.7, 1.8 million people who are surviving a living hell. Everyone on the flotilla is determined to get to Gaza. It is our determination under the Fourth Geneva Convention and under international law to create a maritime lifeline to Gaza. So the only people, no one will stop us except the fascists at sea. If that happens, we will deal with the challenge. Our hearts are with the people in Gaza. Our boats will hopefully be with the people in Gaza. Our aid will be with the people of Gaza. And just remember, any violence that happens on the flotilla will be a direct result of the fascist stormtroopers of the Knesset, if they use violence in order to stop the flotilla. We are non-violent. We are peaceful. This is a humanitarian lifeline to Gaza, and we intend to fulfill our mission.
In recent weeks, the U.S. has been attacking boats near Venezuela, claiming vessels are involved in the drug trafficking trade. U.S. military has also so far struck two of those vessels, second of which was announced by President Donald Trump on Monday. Earlier the same day, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro held a press conference in response to Washington's provocations. He said what's happening is not simple political tensions between the two nations, but U.S. acts of aggression against Venezuela.
This is not tension, it is outright aggression, judicial aggression when they criminalize us, political aggression with their daily threatening statements, diplomatic aggression, and ongoing military aggression. Venezuela is empowered by international law to comprehensively confront this aggression. It is not tension, it is aggression. Today, I can announce that communications with the U.S. government are severed. They are severed by them with their threats of bombs, death, and blackmail. We do not operate under threats. With intimidation, there will never be anything, and they know it. So they have moved from a stage of strained communication to none at all, and history will continue. For a destroyer to send missile experts to assault tuna boats, you know what they were looking for. I don't even need to say it. They were seeking a military incident. If our tuna fishermen had any weapons and used them in Venezuelan waters, it would have been the military incident the warmongers, the extremists who want war in the Caribbean, are seeking. I ask Washington, who gave the order to create this incident? It must be in the operational orders. Who in Washington gave that order?
China has condemned the U.S. for expanding sanctions on Chinese entities despite a series of economic consultations with Beijing.
The U.S. side has overstretched the concept of national security, growing the sanctions list on Chinese entities and stretching longer and longer its long-arm jurisdiction. Such typical unilateral bullying practice violates international law and basic principles underpinning international relations. The Chinese side firmly opposes this and has raised our solemn concerns in our meeting with the U.S. over these issues.
Li emphasized outcomes of recent trade and economic discussions was a result of considerable effort, and he urged the United States to respect the consultation process. The Chinese minister asserted that Washington cannot expect Beijing to address its concerns while simultaneously imposing restrictions on Chinese enterprise. Li called upon the U.S. to promptly lift restrictive measures and collaborate with China to preserve progress attained through bilateral dialogue. The remarks come after a fourth round of Sino-U.S. negotiations in Madrid. The U.S. continues its tariff pressure and sanctions, including efforts by the Trump administration to increase duties on China and India for purchasing Russian oil. Iran has reaffirmed all nations possess an inalienable right to develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, and it should be afforded guaranteed protections against any form of attack or threat against attack in its nuclear facilities. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei underscored the nations must refrain from launching attacks or issuing threats against peaceful nuclear facilities of other states, and he further called upon the international community to take decisive action to prevent increased normalization of lawlessness in international relations. Baghaei made the comments in a social media post regarding a draft resolution tabled by Iran and five partners, including China and Russia, at the ongoing General Conference of the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. Proposed resolution calls for a ban on any act of aggression or threats against nuclear sites and facilities under IAEA safeguards. The Iranian spokesman emphasized this initiative is aimed at safeguarding the integrity of nuclear non-proliferation treaty, the NPT. And this brings us, everyone, to the end of your news bulletin. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. Yesterday we discussed that one of the great challenges that our Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his family, faced came from the hands of the hypocrites, from the munafiqun. This is concept of hypocrisy that we began yesterday and that I want to take going forward, inshallah. As we said, this will be a series that will last maybe 6 or 7 lectures, still working on it. But we're going to try to cover the following things in the series to give us a robust understanding. We're going to look at today in particular the definition of hypocrisy from a linguistic and a religious context. Let's start with the definition. Now, if I were to open up the dictionary, or as I Googled it, but I Googled what is the definition of hypocrisy, and we find that in English the definition of hypocrisy is behavior that contradicts what one claims to believe or feel. So when one acts in a manner that's different than how they actually feel inside, they are considered to be a hypocrite. Or they do something opposite of what they say at another time. So they say something one time, they do something else another time. This is considered in English as hypocrisy. Now when we look at it from the Arabic perspective, here we looked at English language, we look at Arabic language. The word for hypocrisy in Arabic is nifaq. Yeah? Nifaq comes from the root word noon fa qaf. Yeah, nafaq. Yeah? Now the word nafaq, or the root word nafaqa, is quite interesting, right? Because there are many different words that stem from the word, the root word nafaqa. So for example, the word nafaq means a tunnel. Yeah? So when you want to dig a tunnel, something underground, it's known as a nafaq. Yeah? So that's one meaning from the root word nafaqa. Another meaning is the word or the action of nafaqa or infaq, right? Where we spend or we give as an expenditure of goodness, right? Like when we donate something, this is known as infaq. When I look after my family, this is known as infaq. And Allah Azza wa Jal, for example, in Surah Al-Baqarah, verse 254 says, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, anfiqu mimma razaqnakum. Same root word, that all you who believe, spend out of what we have given you. So the first meaning of the from the root word nafaq is tunnel. The second meaning of nafaqa is to spend or do acts of goodness. The third form that takes from it is nifaq, hypocrisy, yeah, or a munafiq, all having the same root word. Now that in itself is real interesting, isn't it? Yeah, that how can a word that on one hand is as strong as nifaq, yeah, to call someone or something hypocritical is not a small thing. But on the other hand, something as beautiful as infaq comes from the same root word, right? And so there has to be some type of link that links these concepts together. And it's really interesting, right? If you like this type of stuff, it tickles, right? It all ties in with the meaning of nafaq, tunnel. Yeah, that infaq is supposed to be passed on to someone the way you pass on something in a tunnel to someone, yeah? Quickly, hidden, secretly. That means when you spend in the way of Allah, don't announce that you're spending in the way of Allah. Give it secretly like you would under a tunnel, for example, when you want to pass something from one to another. And this is where the word infaq ties in with the concept of nafaq, that you give something secretly, quickly, swiftly. You don't make the other person wait for the act of goodness that you're doing. Do it fast. Pass it on quickly without there being much announcement about what is happening. So the word infaq, we can see, ties in really beautiful with the word nafaq, the tunnel. And similarly, when you look at nifaq, hypocrisy, it also ties in with the concept of nafaq, because here it refers to animals that, in order to escape from a predator, they dig a hole or they dig a tunnel and they enter underground. But there are some animals who, when they dig one hole, they dig another hole to escape that predator. So the animal enters this hole. The predator is waiting to capture it because it thinks it'll eventually come out, not realizing that this animal is sneaky and snuck out another hole. This is exactly what a hypocrite does. Yeah, a hypocrite says one thing and does something else, comes out of the other hole. Yeah, and this is how these three words all link together in the Arabic language. From a linguistic perspective, we understand now how the word nafaq, how the word infaq, and how the word nifaq all tie in together, because it's all connected with the concept of a tunnel. And so if we understand that there's this dual nature to a hypocrite, right? The Islamic definition basically can be encapsulated of hypocrisy or nifaq as the following. It's a person who is of a dual nature. They are externally Muslim, internally a kafir. Or they are externally truthful and internally dishonest. Or they are externally pious and sincere, but internally they are corrupt with bad intentions. Or they are externally trustworthy, but internally they are treacherous. Or they are externally your friend, but internally they are your enemy. And this is whom Allah Azza wa Jal describes in Surah Al-Fath, verse number 11, when he says, يَقُولُونَ بِأَلْسِنَتِهِمْ مَا لَيْسَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ. They say that which their tongue, which does not exist in their heart. Yeah? And so it's this dual nature that Allah Azza wa Jal warns us about. And in fact, it's this dual nature that when we look at the description of what God thinks of hypocrites, we find that Allah Azza wa Jal is very harsh when it comes to the description of the hypocrites. And this is something, as we will go through these series, something that we also have to be very careful of, because when we look at some of the branches that come from this, one of the definitions or one of the branches of this is laziness. You know, that a hypocrite will be lazy, and so when it comes to acts of obedience, they will have to kind of force themselves to get up and go pray. But when it comes to doing something else, they're very passionate about it. Yeah, they'll quickly get up and do it. This is viewed by God as hypocrisy, right? Now, there are levels of hypocrisy, as we said, and there are layers of hypocrisy, but we are still within that branch of hypocrisy when we have certain of these qualities. And so we are not far removed from the description that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives or defines when he talks about hypocrisy.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
We've been here to the United States a lot. We used to come every year for a vacation, and we really liked the U.S. We saw it's a great country.
This is a huge country. This is a beautiful country. This country is country for everybody.
That's why we decided we wanted to continue our life and move here to the U.S. and have a future here in the U.S.
The Megaheads are the perfect picture of an American immigrant family. Samir Megahed, an engineer, moved from Egypt with his wife and four children to a quiet cul-de-sac in Tampa, Florida, in 1998. Samir found work, and his eldest sons followed in his footsteps, pursuing engineering degrees. In 2009, the family celebrated becoming American citizens. But their son, Yusuf, was missing.
A friend told us, how is Yusuf? We told him he's fine. He went to a beach trip with some of his friends. He told us, did you see CNN? And we were amazed that he was telling us to check Yusuf on CNN.
In August 2007, Yusuf Megahed was on a road trip with his college friend Mohammed, visiting beaches in the south. They were pulled over for driving 60 in a 45-mile-an-hour zone in the small South Carolina town of Goose Creek. But when Mohammed told the officers he had homemade fireworks in the car, they were both arrested and charged with transporting explosives across state lines.
We saw this as a mistake that hopefully will be solved by the next day. But then the story didn't end the next day, and it continued now for almost 2 years. He was arrested with fireworks. If any white kid or anyone who's not a Middle Eastern would be stopped by a police officer and he would have fireworks, they would consider this to be something ordinary, and they're going to the beach and they are having some fun. But for a Middle Eastern, even this legal stuff that is enjoyed or allowed for any person living here in the U.S., it's considered to be banned or illegal for him. So I think it was almost like a wake-up call that like Arabs and Middle Easterns and people from an Islamic background, they don't enjoy the same rights or same freedoms offered to other people here in the U.S.
Although no formal charges of terrorism were ever filed, Yusuf was held for 10 months in solitary confinement. It was over a year and a half before his trial began.
In the past 2 years, our life is changed completely. It looks like a nightmare. You live under pressure from the biggest government all over the world. If the biggest government all over the world targeting your son, and you know your son is innocent, you're thinking it's crazy. Because Yusuf has a Middle East face and he's carrying Quran, his suspicion on him.
Justify their hatred.
Stop all Muslim immigration. Is that the best way to protect America and our economy from new terror attacks?
The fact of the matter is, these guys want to kill us. We have to fight them, and we have to support law enforcement who want to fight
them.
You know, Clinton goes all over the map here. We got to get these guys before they kill innocent.
And that's got to be the last word.
If you are an 18 to 28-year-old Muslim man, then you should be strip searched.
So there's always confusion about Islam. Is it a religion of violence or peace?
Islam is a violent, I was going to say religion, but it's not a religion. It's a political system. It's a violent political system bent on the overthrow of the governments of the world and world domination.
In the years since the September 11th attacks, advocacy groups claim that the United States has witnessed an anti-Muslim and anti-Arab backlash. Issam Zayem is president of the Cleveland office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. Nationally, CARE has tracked a five-fold surge in civil rights complaints by Muslim Americans since 2001.
The atmosphere and the environment in the media had created a very false perception about Islam and Muslims, especially American Muslims. So we were all lumped in the categories of the fifth column or the terrorists. If you look into the major cities in the country, you will find that there has been major cases all over the country.
The Department of Justice is waging a deliberate campaign of arrest and detention to protect American lives. We're removing suspected terrorists who violate the law from our streets to prevent further terrorist attack. We believe we have Al-Qaeda membership in custody, and we will use every constitutional tool to keep suspected terrorists locked up.
The U.S. Department of Justice refuses to release a tally of how many people it has detained since the beginning of its so-called war on terror. From 2001 to 2003 alone, however, at least 27,000 Arabs and Muslims inside the United States were detained and interrogated by the FBI, and 7,000 arrested. 145,000 Arab and Muslim immigrants were questioned as part of a special registration program, and of those, nearly 14,000 had deportation proceedings started against them. Sami Hammoudi was a PhD student in applied anthropology and an instructor at the University of South Florida, the same university Youssef Megahed attended as an engineering student. He and his family had moved to Tampa from Palestine in 1992, so Sami could pursue his studies. In 2003, he was arrested as a co-conspirator in the Sami Al-Aryan case and charged with terrorism.
Today, the United States Department of Justice is announcing the indictment Sami Al-Aryan, and seven co-conspirators. All of the defendants, if convicted, face the potential of life sentences. Al-Aryan's U.S. associates and Palestinian Islamic Jihad members arrested today include Sami Hammoudi.
At the very beginning of the case, I thought that there are misunderstandings.
They came around 4 a.m., 4 in the morning. They just came knocking on the door very strongly, and my wife woke up and we opened the door. Then they came to me and said, "You are under arrest for charges of terrorism, for supporting terrorism."
Rabia Haddad came to the U.S. to study in 1980, fleeing the violent civil war in Lebanon. After a career with various aid organizations, in 1992, Haddad founded the Global Relief Foundation, or GRF. It became the second largest Islamic charity in the United States, providing aid to 680,000 people worldwide. In 2001, he was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan with his wife and four young children. He worked as the chairman of GRF and volunteered as an imam at the local mosque. 3 months after 9/11, the government designated his charity a terrorist entity.
They raided our offices December 14th. It was a Friday. I remember coming home after the Friday prayer. I felt that I was being followed coming back from the mosque. But I didn't think, you know, I thought, well, if they're raiding our offices in Chicago, it's, I think, normal to put me under surveillance or, you know, whatever. But then maybe an hour after that, they knocked at my door and arrested me, and things went downhill from there.
The theory that gave, let's say, legitimacy to all in their thought to all of these actions was Muslims and Arabs are either terrorists or potential terrorists. So we have to do things to control these communities. And this is what they did, and this is what they are still doing. Nothing changed.
Back in Tampa, Youssef's court-appointed lawyer, Adam Allen, worried that the prevailing political and media climate would make his case nearly impossible to win.
Initially, obviously, when you are appointed to represent somebody from the Middle East originally, who is charged with the transportation of explosive materials, as a defense lawyer, you have some great concerns about the ability to successfully represent this individual. The media reaction was that this was some sort of terrorist-related activity. The United States Attorney's Office, although not saying that, certainly wasn't saying it wasn't. And that sort of swelled around this case.
Gary Meringer served as the foreman of the jury in Yusuf Mugahid's trial. He says the tone for the trial was set on the very first day.
The judge asked, does anybody here consider themselves an expert with explosives? And then, and he followed that with, is anybody here fluent in Arabic? And not knowing at all, when you go into being paneled on a jury, you don't know anything about the case. Just some person sitting there in a business suit, and all of a sudden I'm hearing Arabs and explosives, and it's like, whoa.
I mean, if you ask the man on the street, hey, the defendant's from the Middle East, and the government's alleging he's got explosive materials in his trunk, all of my colleagues said, there's no way you're going to win this at trial.
We listened to almost two full weeks of evidence. 40-plus witnesses were put on by the government. I don't know how many documents. It was, I think, over 100.
As the evidence came in, and it kept pointing away from Yusuf, and it kept showing that, you know, if even though there was no physical evidence tying him to it, once it became clear that these items were completely harmless, I felt we should win at trial, and we could win at trial.
The jury, after 3 days of looking hard and fast at the evidence, said, you know, it's the burden of the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was in possession of these materials and that he knew it. It's not sufficient that you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're not guilty of a crime in this country. And there was, the feeling was, you know, there really wasn't any evidence of that.
When the verdict was not guilty, it was a wonderful feeling. There were tears from the client and the family, and probably the best hug I've ever received from my client's father. Several of the agents that worked for the FBI came up and congratulated us and told us that they were not dissatisfied with the verdict in the case. And it was good to know, and I think I was even quoted in the paper as saying, you know, the system worked. As a lawyer who tries cases and understands the Constitution and the purpose of jury trials and the whole notion that the jury is the true representation of our government. It's a check on our government, and it's what makes us America, is that it's not the government that decides whether somebody's guilty. It's the community, because we are government of the people. And the people in this case, despite all the government's best efforts, said, you know what, you're wrong. It was about one of the proudest days I've ever had as a lawyer professionally. It was wonderful.
We went in and talked to the judge. He counseled us never to talk to anybody ever again about anything that had happened. And as a result of that, we all took all of our notes and all the charts and everything, and we just gave them to the bailiff to shred and burn, and thinking we would never, ever revisit this.
Well, he was acquitted of federal explosive charges just this past Friday, but today Yusuf Mugahid is back in the hands of federal agents, and his family tonight is outraged.
On Friday, after a three-week trial, Yusuf Mugahid walked out of a Tampa courthouse a free man.
I'm very happy.
Mugahid was acquitted on all counts of federal explosives charges, but his freedom was short-lived. Monday, to the surprise of his father, Mugahid was arrested all over again.
Arrest my son. They kidnapped my son.
Samir Mugahid, Yusuf's father, says they were walking out of this Walmart on Bruce B. Downs when more than a dozen customs enforcement agents surrounded them.
They separated between me and my son, and they surrounded me. I tried to use the telephone. They didn't allow me to use the telephone and put the Yusuf in a small car. I tried to stop in front of this car to let Yusuf to speak to his lawyer. They didn't allow me to do this. They kidnapped my son.
I would have personally walked into wherever he needed to be, but instead they chose to surveil him for days after the trial and to arrest him and his father as they are walking out of a grocery store, and to surround them by cars and agents and whisk him away in a vehicle.
Tuesday morning, I got to work, I opened up my browser, pulled up the news, and I saw that Youssef had been arrested on Monday at a Walmart with his dad by immigration authorities. And this has only happened, and I was thinking about this morning, when I saw the Grand Canyon was another example, but where the air got sucked out of my lungs. I read the story and I was like, like that. It just was so improbable. After all the time we had spent to find out that he hadn't done anything.
I spend a lot of my time telling the government they're wrong. That's what federal public defenders do. We tell the government they're wrong, and we argue that they're wrong, and we argue what they're trying to do to our clients is wrong. But we respect the system, and we were a part of the system, and we believe in the system. At that moment in time, not only did I not want to be a part of the system, but I didn't want to be an American. I was no longer proud of our system, and I was certainly not proud of our government.
Many a time, you know, I'd be sitting in my cell all alone, and I would have this slit in the wall that was about maybe 5 inches wide. That was the only window to the outside world. I would only see shadows and, you know, the colors of the sunset, but never really the sun. And I would sit there and wonder if I'm ever going to see a sunset again.
Of course, to this day, not a single charge has been filed against GRF or against any of the employees of GRF, including myself.
I was acquitted from all charges, and in the media, the jurors were saying that we didn't know why they brought him to the case. They took the first decision in half an hour. They voted without any discussion that I was innocent of all charges.
They didn't have enough to bring criminal charges, to charge me as a criminal, as a terrorist. The only accusation they would make against me is that I had overstayed my visa.
I was acquitted. The second day in the morning, ICE came. My attorney asked the judge to release me, but the judge wouldn't accept that.
The lawyer had told them that, like, he should be out in, like, 2 or 3 days, just until they process the paperwork and everything. And we kept waiting, and then they transferred him to the immigration facility. And every time we would keep trying, like, for the first, I think, week or two, like, even, like, my dad's lawyer couldn't get any information on what's going on. It wasn't something that was, like, unheard of, and it wasn't something like that I thought couldn't ever happen, because I saw it happen or I've heard of it happening, but it was just, I didn't expect it to happen to my father.
I was denied bond based on the fact that they considered me a danger to the community, when my whole community was actually demonstrating and protesting and what have you. And they were treating me like the most dangerous, worst criminal ever. When I was taken from my cell to my first immigration hearing, the security they had was unbelievable. They had a sheriff's deputy stationed almost every 10 feet all the way from the door of my cell to the building almost next door. My trial was behind closed doors. I was put in solitary confinement on a floor all by myself in a very tight cell. And they had a camera fixed right on me. The cell door had a small window, and the camera was right there. It was clear then that this wasn't about immigration or me overstaying my visa or anything like that. They were going after me with everything they got.
One time I passed through the room, observation room of the guard, and I saw my picture there. So I asked one of the guards why my picture is there. He said, because you are a threat, and we have to keep an eye over you for 24 hours. And this was from ICE. They gave them this information.
The thing that got to me the most was just not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing whether I'll be able to see him again, whether he'll, you know, just be there for, like, these major events in our lives.
Very quickly, we presented to ICE that I have a passport. I don't need a visa. I can go tomorrow to my country, and I am willing to do that. They said, no, we have to wait.
You'll try appealing, and then there would be different court dates, and, like, nothing would come out of it, and then different promises. And then at the end, they told us, if you just leave voluntarily, we promise he'll be on the flight with you. We kept expecting to find my father there, and he didn't show up. At the end, the immigration officer told him, he's like, I can't respond to your questions anymore.
After almost 3 years in prison, two of those in solitary confinement, Sami Hammoudi was found innocent of all terrorism charges. But instead of being released, he was transferred to an immigration jail. For 6 months, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, refused to either release or deport him, even after he agreed to voluntary deportation to reunite with his family. Hammoudi's lawyers brought ICE to court. 2 days before the trial, Hammoudi was deported in secret.
So on the 23rd, they took me to the airport and deported me. So it wasn't their plan to deport me this way. If we didn't go to the federal judge and ask him to either release me or deport me, they wouldn't do that.
We didn't even know, because we were used to him calling, and then he didn't call for 2 days, so we didn't know what was going on. And my mom called his lawyer, and he didn't, like, have an idea of what's going on, and we kept trying to get in touch with people. And, like, she was kind of freaking out, because it was just, you couldn't get in touch with him. No one knew what was happening to him.
It's the humiliation of, being deported and traveling in a T-shirt and sweatpants and prison shoes and having these agents with you. It's especially for somebody who has my good name and my reputation are the only assets I have in this world. I mean, I don't have any money in any bank accounts. I don't have any land. I don't have any. But this is the only thing I have. And the U.S. government made sure to attack me on these two. They have ruined my reputation. They have ruined my good name. And they have accused me unjustly of things that are complete fabrications. They could not prove anything because there was nothing there. But with the USA Patriot Act, they didn't have to prove anything. It was enough for the government to say, we suspect.
They think that accusing people, destroying their lives, is something they can do. This is what worries me. It is the arrogance of the powerful.
Sometimes I think back and I don't even know. Like, it still seems like a dream away. And I don't really know how we got through all of it. It seems like it was something that even happened to someone else.
America before, I won't say before September 11th, America before the USA Patriot Act was one thing, and after the USA Patriot Act was a completely different country. I will not be exaggerating if I said America today is a police state just like any other third world police states.
It is actually the Dark Ages. It is the mentality of the Dark Ages, where governments could do anything they wanted to do.
In criminal court, the burden of proof is with the prosecution. They would have to make their case. They would have to prove. In immigration, all they have to do is just cast doubt upon them.
They do whatever they want to do. And they have the laws. They have everything they want to lie, even lie.
All these things that you hear about, freedom and, equality and all these other things, it just seemed like more and more of a facade. And it was just, I don't know. Like, the hypocrisy was just kind of overwhelming, and and just having to deal with that uncertainty on a daily basis was just very nerve-wracking and very exhausting. And
thank you. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history, 2016. Imam Khamenei. After the passage of 3 years or more in the first phase of Bi'tha, the Holy Prophet ﷺ had managed to convert 30 or 40 people to Islam through his covert call to Islam. These 30 or 40 people tolerated all those hardships and increased in number on a daily basis. Each day, they were witness to what they did to Ammar and Bilal. They were witness to the torturing and martyrdom of Sumayyah and Yasir. They were witness to these things, but they still converted to Islam. That is the way righteousness is promoted. The mere rising of the flag in peace and security will not help promote righteousness. Righteousness will be promoted only when there is steadfastness and perseverance on the part of righteous people who believe in righteousness. There is a verse in the Quran, chapter 48, verse 29, that says, Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and those with him are firm against the disbelievers, compassionate among themselves. Muhammadun Rasulullah, وَالَّذِينَ مَعْهُ أَشِدَّاءُ مَعَ الْكُفَّارِ رُحَمَاءُ بَيْنَهُمْ The phrase, firm against the disbelievers, does not mean that Muslims are involved in a constant war with the disbelievers. Rather, it means strength and solidity. Firm means solid here. This solidity may be manifested in a particular manner on the battlefield. It may also be manifested in another way when negotiating with the enemy. Just see how the Prophet ﷺ talked to his enemies when it was necessary to do so. His plans were the embodiment of solidity, without any flaws. In the Battle of Ahzab, the Prophet ﷺ entered into negotiations with the enemy, but it was not usual negotiations. The details of these negotiations are recorded in the history. Battles and negotiations were both carried out in a solid manner. Cooperation was also carried out firmly. That is the meaning of the phrase, firm against the disbelievers. The phrase, compassionate among themselves, means that Muslims are lenient with one another. رُحَمَاءُ بَيْنَهُمْ Muslims do not treat each other firmly. It is time for expressing affections when Muslims are together. The resistance at the beginning of Bi'tha resulted in 3 years of unbelievable resistance in Shi'b Abi Talib. They lived in the sizzling sun in a valley near Mecca for 3 years. There were no plants and no water. And this is no joke. The Prophet ﷺ, Abi Talib, Khadija, and all Muslims and their families lived in this valley in the holes of the mountains.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done.
Civil Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to all our listeners from around the world. I hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning, and this is our schedule. We start tonight's lineup with today's special, a special daily mixed format program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. They will be followed by Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. And to round up this hour's program, we have our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour. Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam to you, dear brother, dear sister, in faith and humanity. So welcome, you are listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio, which in this program we're going to speak about turning setbacks into success. So be with us.